Can we do a grant?
We're going to do a grant for that.
Good morning.
Subcommittee on Human Services. And we are going to have, just to give you an idea, we're going to have one work session today and three public hearings. We'll discuss the other possible work sessions we go through and why we're not having it. But Linda, you want to lead us through this real quickly, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, we're starting out with a federal grant request from Public Health related to congenital heart defects. And Kate Wilcox is here to do a brief summary.
Co-Chair Bates and Co-Chair Nathanson and members of the committee, good morning. I'm Kate Wilcox, the manager for the Maternal and Child Health section of the Oregon Health Authority Public Health Division. And to my left,
I'm Suzanne Zane, and I'm a maternal and child health epidemiologist in Kate's section.
We're here to request approval to apply for the Center for Disease Control and Prevention's Surveillance of Congenital Heart Defects Across the Lifespan Cooperative Agreement. Surveillance in this situation is the public health function of monitoring the health status of Oregonians with congenital heart defects. Anomalies of the heart and circulation constitute one of the most common congenital defects, approximately 1% of all births. We estimate there are about 23,000 Oregonians with congenital heart defects. Many adults who had congenital heart defects identified in childhood have then subsequently been lost to follow-up, increasing their risk for later age heart conditions and early death. This risk is a particular concern for pregnant women. This is not unique in Oregon. It's a national situation that CDC hopes to address through these cooperative agreements. The goal of this grant is to develop and implement approaches for identifying the prevalence of congenital heart defects using population-based data and identifying gaps in the continuity of care across the lifespan. Specifically, we will first link multiple data sets to identify the current prevalence of congenital heart defects. Secondly, we'll follow up with medical records reviews of sample cases to identify system gaps in the continuity of care. And third, we'll work with partners such as cardiologists, pediatricians, family practice physicians to identify system solutions to those gaps in the continuity of care. The data sources we'll be linking include Medicaid claims, all payers, all claims, hospital discharge, vital records, and the Oregon Child Health Information Data System, ORCIDS, for nurse home visiting programs. The cooperative agreement is a four-year grant providing $425,000 per year for a total of $1.7 million, and the grant period is October 2015 through September 30, 2019. It requires no state match and no maintenance of effort, and we are going to fulfill the work requirements by repurposing existing staff, so we won't require any new positions with this grant. And we'll be contracting for specific expertise as we need it. Thank you. Happy to take some questions.
Thanks. Questions? I read all through this morning carefully, and it struck me this is sort of a one-time look, sort of a survey, one-time shot. What's it look like from birth to 15, 16, 17 years old, and that information is going back to CDC, and then they must have other states doing it too. Mm-hmm. So just trying to get an idea of what's happening to people with congenital deep heart defects.
Correct.
That's basically what it does, right?
Correct.
You could have just said that. Okay.
Yeah. Sorry.
Just saying. Okay.
Mr. Chair, would you like a motion?
I sure would.
I move to approve the request to apply for a grant to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in the amount of up to $425,000 a year for 4 years to identify the prevalence of congenital heart defects.
We have a motion before us. Any questions, discussion? Any opposition? Seeing none, work session is closed, and you've got your bill. You got your grant request completed.
Thank you very much.
Good
Thank
luck.
You.
And we'll need a carrier in full, and you might, are you going to be here Friday?
That's fine.
Fine. Okay, thank you. Representative Nathanson will carry it in full. Now we're going to open up a public hearing, and we're going to start with Senate Bill 875. I think we have several people signed up to come up and talk to us about it. Maybe I'm wrong. You got
He's grabbing it.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Please identify yourself to the committee and for the record, and we'd like to hear your testimony.
Okay. Hello, Senator Bates, Representative Nathanson, and members of the committee. Thank you for hearing this bill and giving me the opportunity to speak. My name is Jennifer Knapp. I am testifying in favor of Senate Bill 875. I'm the mother of a child with adrenal insufficiency, a public school special education teacher, and director of Adrenal Insufficiency United. I speak to you today wearing all three of those hats. I'm going to hold off some of the descriptions about adrenal insufficiency and let Dr. Lindsay Nicol answer those questions. The reason we need this bill is that right now not all public K-12 schools are willing to train their staff to administer the injection a child with adrenal insufficiency needs during a crisis, SOD-CORTEF. Some have even said that it's not allowed. However, Oregon does allow personnel to administer glucagon and the EpiPen. Senate Bill 875 will add children with adrenal insufficiency to the safeguards already in place for other students. Due to the training personnel will receive, I believe this bill will also help reduce the chances that a child will experience a crisis while at school. Many children can take extra oral doses in the early stages of illness or for less severe injuries. These doses are usually enough to stabilize the child while he or she recovers from the incident. Personnel who are trained about adrenal insufficiency and the specific needs of their students will be able to spot warning signs and take action early before an injection is needed. As a teacher, I understand that this bill is asking school personnel to do more and that we already are doing so much more than teachers used to do. However, since schools do not have full-time nurses, there's no other option. Playground accidents can happen. There are field trips, before and after school activities, athletics, natural disasters, and lockdowns, all scenarios where the only help available may be that of the staff at the school. For these reasons, school staff must be trained to administer the injection. The only other safe option is a full-time nurse assigned to each child with adrenal insufficiency. A full-time school nurse position listing for Eugene 4J states the starting salary at between $35,000 and $65,000 a year. The fiscal on this bill is much more economical than hiring a school nurse for each student with adrenal insufficiency. Once the system and materials are in place, the staff position to implement this bill will no longer be needed. Although I feel the $50,000 price tag for this position is high, it's only for a short time. And if that's too much and endangers this bill, I'm more than qualified to write those protocols and train myself, and will do so. In fact, we already have an online training that we've developed for school personnel that has been viewed by teachers and school nurses. 875 will make Oregon the first state to ensure the safety of public school students with adrenal insufficiency. We plan to use this bill to start working in other states. Please pass this bill onto the Senate and House floors for a vote and let Oregon become the model that all other states will follow. Thank you for your time, and I can take any questions.
Dear Senator Bates, I'm Representative Nathanson and members of the Joint Subcommittee on Human Services. I'm Dr. Lindsay Nicol. I'm one of the pediatric endocrinologists at Dornbecker Children's Hospital associated with Oregon Health and Science University. And I'm representing our division in support of this bill. Our department has well over 100 patients with adrenal insufficiency for various diagnoses, including congenital adrenal hyperplasia, Addison's disease, and panhypopituitarism. There are other conditions which can cause this insufficiency. An injection of what we call SOD-CORTEF can be a life-saving medication for a child. It's a rare event, but it's certainly life-saving. And children who suffer unpredictable serious injury or illness at school can suddenly develop adrenal insufficiency and need a stress dose of injectable glucocorticoids. And this needs to be administered emergently. We can't necessarily wait for a parent to come, and we can't necessarily wait for the EMS to respond to this situation. SOD-CORTEF is safe. So a teacher or a staff member who's trained cannot, who doesn't measure the exact dose, cannot harm the child. Harm can only come from not administering the dose. So giving too much is not harmful. And waiting again for an ambulance to arrive can sometimes be a life-threatening event. There are cases in which we have lost patients due to adrenal insufficiency because this injection was not administered. It is similar to an injection that's given to children with diabetes, so we're not reinventing the wheel on how this type of injection is administered. We train staff at school to administer glucagon, which is almost done in an identical manner. So this is not something that's going to be new in terms of dose administration. So we are in full support of SB 875, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Questions? Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many children in Oregon might have this condition?
We estimate, just in our division, we're treating about 100 children with adrenal insufficiency. There are other practices within the greater Portland area and southern Oregon that would also be probably not as many as those, but maybe 20 to 60 more children.
So maybe a few hundred or even less than that.
Correct.
Okay. Could you please describe the difficulty of administering the injection?
I think the difficulty in administering the injection comes from the anxiety of dealing with the needles. The injection comes with a solute that you have to inject into a vial, mix, pull back on a syringe, and then directly inject into the muscle. That being said, if it doesn't go directly into the muscle, it will still work and it will not harm the child if it's not administered directly into a muscle. I, as a physician, don't think that it's technically difficult to give. Any nurse or EMS responder should know how to give an IM injection. It's not a technically difficult procedure.
But we're talking about training the people who are not nurses and the EMS technicians.
Right.
So that's one of my concerns. For example, if I were in a school and had a job in a school, would I be trained to do this?
Right. So let me give you an example. So we have over 800 children with type 1 diabetes through that we see just through our division, even more through the state of Oregon. There needs to be a designated person trained to administer glucagon, which is not required by a medical person. It could be done by staff, a designated staff person. So there are already trained personnel throughout schools in Oregon who know how to give intramuscular injection nearly identical to giving this emergency injection of Solu-Cortef or glucocorticoids.
Thank you. That's very helpful to have that comparison. So are we talking about training all staff at all schools or just a staff in those schools where there's a child with this potential need?
Go ahead. If I may, I can answer that. What this bill will require is that all staff get a general training about adrenal insufficiency just to let them know that there is a student in the school with the condition. And then the school will determine a number of staff that will get the full training that will include the injection training. So that may be the classroom teacher, a health aide, and a principal, for instance. So that would be up to the school to decide which teachers or other staff to designate.
Is it possible?
I know where you're trying to go. Okay. Just go.
Yeah. Is it possible that those persons already trained to do diabetes injections would then just be given this additional responsibility?
Possibly. I think it would depend on the school. For instance, the school that I teach at, if there's a fourth grade student, all the fourth grade teachers are trained. And so some schools may choose to train the classroom teacher but also possibly train those others. Again, that will be left up to the school to determine.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And I think the other question I thought you were leading to was, if you haven't got a diagnosed case in your school system or at your site, no one's going to get trained because it's not necessary. So I just, I read the bill pretty carefully, so that's the way I read the bill.
Mm-hmm.
It's only when you have a child that's been diagnosed, and this is a pretty rare condition, and the real problem of these children dying is that they're undiagnosed.
Mm-hmm.
That's the real risk, but you aren't answering that question because you can't, and I realize that. Senator Steiner Hayward.
I'm good, thank you, Representative.
Nice to see you. Good to see you back, by the way.
Thank you.
Again.
Thank you. Good to be
Love
back.
Love to see you here.
Thank you.
For those of you who don't know, this Representative Kenny Geyer had an accident and showing incredible fortitude and courage, which I wouldn't have. Actually had a bad accident. Is back to work already. I appreciate you being here.
I miss you all.
And I would tell him what you did, but it'd be a HIPAA violation, so I'm going to leave it alone. I'm glad to have you back.
She put it on her newsletter, so it's not exactly a HIPAA violation.
She went head over heels on a bicycle and has a hairline fracture in your vertebrae.
Yep. So this seems like a small price to pay, $333 per kid if it's about 150 kids, or $500 per kid if it's 100 kids. Following up on Representative Nathanson's questions, I'm assuming that whatever school personnel is identified would do so voluntarily. Is that correct?
Yes, I believe so. That
they wouldn't be forced to do that against
No, I think it will be voluntary, but that the school will ask certain staff to be trained.
Okay, and just follow-up question, Mr. Mm-hmm. Chair. I also remember from the stand that you had a couple weeks ago that there's a problem with ambulances often not carrying this because apparently they don't have room, but it's a teeny little vial. I'm wondering, since we're here and we're on the issue, if you could just address that really briefly, even though it's not a part of this bill.
Okay. So we do have another bill. It was Senate Bill 874, and that bill would have required ambulances to carry a glucocorticoid or some other medicine for adrenal insufficiency. It would have trained EMTs and ER nurses to identify and treat adrenal insufficiency. That bill was modified, and now Oregon Health Authority will be gathering and disseminating information about adrenal insufficiency. I'm still hoping for an amendment, but the hearing is tomorrow, so I'm running out of time. Okay. And I think time was kind of our issue when it was in the Senate. So that's something that our group would still like to see happen in the future.
So just a final comment that that would make this even more imperative if we're not able to pass that.
Correct.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, now if I could.
Now you want. Okay.
Now I want to talk.
I'll get you to do it.
Thank you. I want to say that I've worked closely with Ms. Knapp, and we've had some very productive conversations, and I appreciate your advocacy on this issue, and I completely support 875, right? I'm strongly in support of this bill. It makes a lot of sense. Kids aren't always able to articulate their situation, and I would reassure the non-medical folks who haven't had to deal with learning how to give injections that we teach non-medical people all the time, whether to give intramuscular or subcutaneous injections, whatever it is. We do it for parents of kids with diabetes where it's subcutaneous. We do it for family members of people who self-inject with medicines for MS or whatever it is that they do at home. We do this all the time, and people learn very quickly. It's very simple. So I just want to reassure folks who haven't dealt with this. I know you've
Thank
talked
you.
About it, Doctor, but
yeah.
You know, speaking both as a physician and somebody who's taught people to do this, it's really not a big deal.
It's not technically
That's
difficult.
Why God invented oranges.
Yes.
bam. So it's really not that big a deal. And I would just say I appreciate, Ms. Knapp, your concern about the ambulances. I think that most, I mean, I could be wrong, but I think that the testimony that I heard when we were hearing this bill in Senate Healthcare was that most ambulances, virtually all, do carry some kind of a glucocorticoid that can be used to deal with this. The challenge, of course, when you have a patient in the field is that the differential diagnosis for something like this is huge. And knowing exactly what to administer, and it can be tough for paramedics to feel comfortable injecting a glucocorticoid, which in the case of a diabetic, for example, can only exacerbate if they're hyperglycemic, right? If their sugars are too high, glucocorticoids exacerbate that problem. So it's a tough problem in the field if you don't have a known diagnosis on mm-hmm. someone. If someone's wearing a bracelet saying, I have adrenal insufficiency, well, that's one thing, right? So I want to be clear to the committee that I personally have spent a lot of time thinking about this issue this session and talking with Ms. Knapp and other advocates, and I really support 875 a lot. 874 is a lot more complicated, and I appreciate that, but that's just kind of where I'm at. But 875, I think, is a great bill, and I really support it.
Thank you.
So thank you for your work on this.
Thank you.
Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair Bates. So first of all, I understand the logic of not waiting for a crisis to come up with a solution. That makes sense in this. I am curious with how rare this disease is. Do we know the numbers of how many cases in the school setting where we've actually had an adrenal crisis situation over previous years?
I'm not sure about that. I know we have a very large Facebook group, and one of our members, who is not from Oregon, lost a child who broke a leg at school, and the child died before help arrived.
It is rare, but it's balanced by it's a life-threatening event. It's not like we're asking school officials to make a medical diagnosis. This child has adrenal insufficiency. They're going to be identified as such as having it. Giving an injectable life-saving medication is the level of decision-making is not complicated. The child's going to look very ill. The person's going to be deciding whether to dial 911 or not. So we're not putting personnel in a position to make medical decisions in a very complicated way. These children are very sick looking and need medical attention right away. So,
can I follow up? Sure. May I follow up?
Yes, of course.
So, based on that, I'm just to make sure I'm understanding correctly. So, there should never be an instance where someone is given this medication or injection that has not already been pre-identified as a student with
Correct.
This condition.
Okay. They're going to be identified as adrenally insufficient when they walk in the school. Yeah.
Representative Boone.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Bates. So Dr. Nicole said you can't really overdose a student, so it's a safe thing. So I would think that in the case of an EMS or the ambulance folks, and I'll just make it a rural setting where I'm comfortable with, and when I sat on the fire department on their medical team and I was just a first responder, we're not allowed to do a lot of stuff. But when you have a case where someone's pulled over on the side of the highway and they called 911 and fire department's the first one there because the ambulance is 45 minutes out and you get there and someone says this person's adrenal insufficient and here's the stuff or we had the stuff or do you have the stuff? If you didn't have it, you couldn't give it. If they don't have it, you couldn't give it. If an EMS service has it, they could give it right then, and then there you are.
Yeah.
It just seems to me, and this is a bit of a rant, we see more insurance companies practicing medicine than we do people, you know, in the school. Yeah, I know. We could go on. But I think it's a small thing to ask, and I guess I'm talking about both of these bills, but for school personnel, when something happens, it goes on just emergency setting. Anybody who's trained would, I think, be morally obligated to submit this medication. I guess you can tell where I am on this one.
Are you for it or against it?
Totally support.
Any other questions? We're in a public hearing, so we'll be working the bill today. We'll be working it soon, I'm sure. Mrs. Knapp, I appreciate bringing this forward to us. I think you did a great job on it. I'm also a physician. You know, we like to think that what we do in medicine, and I hope Dr. Nicole, you'll agree with what I would say. We like things kind of like secret, like we're really cool things we do, you know. We want the public to know a lot of what we do. You guys could do too, but we're not going to let you. You know? So you're taking sort of the mystery away from medicine, and I'll take it as a personal insult, but I'll let it go. But seriously, it's a good bill. You've done a good job on this. It's a rare, very rare condition, obviously. But once it's diagnosed, we should be able to treat it any place in our society, not just at schools, but at major events. Things can happen suddenly, as you know. And Dr. Nicole, you know this better than I do with the number of people you treat. I've lost two patients to this in my 30 years in practice. One was a woman who had a hysterectomy. She was undiagnosed. Very simple hysterectomy. Everything went fine. They checked her at midnight, and she was dead. Mm-hmm. Wow. She had adrenal insufficiency. The stress of the surgery killed her. Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay, those things happen. And it's very sad. And to add to the injury to the case, at that time, the insurance company said, we're not paying for a pre-screening on routine surgeries anymore.
Oh, my God.
True case.
Should we start calling them doctor insurance?
Yeah, and so that got fixed. But that would have been picked up in a simple chem screen. Your sodium was like 115. So you know what I'm talking about. And so I appreciate you bringing this forward, and I think we'll see some action on it pretty soon. I'm not quite sure why it's got a $50,000 on it. It's a one-time cost, by the way. It's not a continuing cost. It's just to set up the website and get the training set up and run, and she's probably already done it. And so I'm not sure why we're even down here with this thing. It should just go on out, but we'll make sure this thing moves through. Okay? So thank you for your time. I know you've got to get back to work. Appreciate you coming down from Portland. Thank you.
Happy to do so.
Thank you so much.
Close a public hearing. Oops.
We got her.
Oh, I'm sorry. Tricia Smith, you wanted to speak to it, too. I'm sorry. got added on. Sorry. Thank you for reminding me.
Good morning, Mr. and Madam Co-Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association. OSEA is a public sector and private sector union of predominantly classified school employees. I'm here today to offer, in spite of the very strong support in this committee for this bill, some words of concern about not necessarily whether or not school personnel should be trained to administer medication to a student who has adrenal insufficiency and is in crisis, but to tell you that this is yet one more situation where school personnel who are not medical personnel do not have the comfort level that medical personnel have for dealing with medical issues, medical crises, let alone administering medication in a crisis. The school personnel I'm talking about, when you're thinking about this bill, I know you're thinking about teachers and you're thinking about principals and thoughtful administration of this law. Out there in the hinterlands, what will happen is an educational assistant will see a video. There is no school nurse in that school district. There is no medical person who will be talking to that educational assistant. And what she gets, she'll get from the video. And she will be directed to administer this medication, not volunteer necessarily to do so. It will be part of her job. Our members are very, very concerned that over the last, particularly the last 20 or 25 years, more and more medical procedures are being loaded on them as we have fewer and fewer medical personnel in our schools. They really aren't the people that we want taking care of medically fragile children, let alone medically fragile children in a life or death crisis. I believe medical personnel are better suited to that. In Senate Bill 874, we heard from medical personnel who were concerned about administering this medication. If medical personnel are concerned about administering this medication, why in the world should we be so comfortable with an educational assistant or a school secretary administering the medication or a playground assistant on the playground? I only ask you to be aware of what we are loading on these people as we continue to ignore the crisis of medically fragile children in our schools. They need school nurses. They need medical personnel. And you are the committee that at some point will be able to help us with that. And so as you pass Senate Bill 875, I hope that you will remember what you're doing to those educational assistants out there in the hinterlands who don't have the support that they really need to be the medical professionals that they are being asked to be. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions? Obviously there are.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Smith, you and I participated on a work group several months ago. It was last year. And in the course of our discussions on that committee, you described to me some types of situations that were rather startling to me, responsibilities that were being assigned or delegated to school personnel, particularly for medically fragile students who were at school. Are you able or willing to share with the committee a few examples of the types of procedures that are being required?
Our children are like the rest of our population. They come to school with every form and manner of ailment, illness, and disability. And while they're at school, we have to take not only educate them, but we have to take care of them. And with the disappearance of school nurses, that has meant usually these children are on individual education programs. They are assigned an instructional assistant or an educational assistant to care for them. Sometimes these kids have breathing tubes that get clogged. My educational assistant is the person that's going to have to take care of that. They may be 18 years old, 6'4", and need diapers. The educational assistant will take care of that. They need to be moved from their wheelchair to some other thing. Educational assistants who go to school to teach kids to read are going to learn how to do that, we hope. They are dealing with children who have violence as part of their disability, and they are being injured as a result of that. Every kind of ailment, illness, or disability that you can think about happens in our schools. And more, it's the classified person who is responsible for taking care of those medical conditions that that child has. And it's a silent crisis in our school system. And we truly, truly hope that you will help us help these kids, because they're not being served as they should be. And our members are so fraught with worry about what will happen to these kids if they make a mistake.
Thank you.
Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Tricia, you said you didn't really say there were any medical procedures that these people had to perform, because I would assume if they're not trained and licensed as such, they could not do that.
There are a number of procedures. I can't give you the breadth of procedures, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, Representative Boone, that my members are asked to perform. But school nurses, if there is a school nurse in the region and the district has a cooperative agreement with the ESD that has a school nurse, for example, that school nurse can delegate her responsibilities, his or her responsibilities, to the school personnel taking care of the student, because the nurse may be 20 miles away. So they do perform medical procedures. You know, they're certainly not doing things that my doctor does. I'm not suggesting that. But they are very, very close to the line. And when you think about the things that they do and you learn about the things that they do, it should be very concerning to you. They should be performed by medical personnel.
Well, do your people, are they trained in CPR?
If their administrator requires it.
Well,
the law, let me just back up. I think I get confused about which things we are now required to do. CPR has been discussed in this building as a mandate for some time, and I can't actually recall off the top of my head if you've passed that bill yet.
Okay.
If you haven't passed the bill, it's up to their superintendent or principal to determine whether or not they should be trained or their own initiative.
Well, so assuming that your people who work for you and our people who work in the schools and the ones I know who are classified, at least in my district, are very dedicated to their work and to the kids that they serve, and I probably can't imagine an emergency, like some kid having an adrenal insufficiency emergency and having somebody not jumping to help them do something. And wouldn't you rather have them doing that while they wait, while they've called 911, then they wait for the EMS team and they wait for an ambulance? And it, like I said, in my district, if they're in one part of the county and they need them down in the south part of the county, it's going to be 45 minutes minimum. And it's just a kismet moment if they're close. So wouldn't you rather have, and don't you think these people would rather do what they can to help these kids rather than say, whoa, wait, I'm uncomfortable doing that. I just can't imagine that. Can you address that?
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, Representative Boone, absolutely. They do care about their students, and they would care about someone they walked by on the street that was having a medical crisis. I would think we all would. That's not the point of my testimony or our concern. Our concern is these requirements roll downhill. Well, we don't have medical personnel to do it, so we'll have to have school personnel to do it. Well, the administrators and the teachers are too busy, we'll have the instructional assistant do it. It's our point is we need medical personnel in our schools to be performing medical procedures for our students, not instructional or educational assistants or school secretaries. They are not the proper personnel for the breadth of medical issues that we see in schools today. That's my point. This is yet another one of those issues, but it's certainly not the only one. And our point is we have lost our medical personnel in our schools. They used to be there. They used to deal with these things. They're no longer there. So as you pass Senate Bill 875, we hope that you will also look toward how we can get healthcare dollars paying for healthcare professionals in our schools dealing with healthcare.
And a final. I need to say, I think you're looking to us to provide this. The decision you're looking at is made by the school boards. In my district, we've had offers and we have everything ready to go, and a school board can vote it down, having a health clinic, a school nurse, et cetera. I agree.
Yes.
Every school should have a school nurse. That's not the case. But talk to your school boards, yeah, and that's where you need to go. And just saying, I still think this is a very, very small thing to ask. It sounds like this procedure is easier than learning CPR, which is pretty darn easy anymore.
We're going to be all morning, obviously.
Yeah.
Thank you. But
that's
good. But good conversation.
It's a good
Representative Senator Winters.
And I have visited some of the schools that have some situations that Trish has talked about. And I probably something that we really long term need to grapple with, because I can't concur more that we're asking of individuals to actually do things that are beyond the scope of even when they were hired. And there was a time when we did have nurses in the schools and what have you. And probably, even though it's the local board's decision, they may need some direction from this body. We can't continually offload things simply because the local districts aren't doing what they should be doing. And I just tend to, you know, having visited some of my schools and knowing that some of this exists, that we probably, this body, need to probably actually begin to address these medical issues that exist in the school. I put that out there because I do think it is our responsibility to provide some leadership.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, thank you, Senator Winters, and Representative Boone, for your comments. The point I'm trying to make about healthcare in schools is one that we addressed in the work group that Representative Nathanson and I participated in, and that is right now school boards are, you know how strapped they are in terms of funding and have cut for 25 years. The problem we have is a school board is faced with not enough money and the choice of hiring a nurse or a teacher, and so they choose the teacher. The point that I would like you to consider is that healthcare has, for these students, has moved from doctor's offices to schools, but the healthcare dollars have not moved. And some of those dollars that are meant to provide healthcare services to these students need to come into the schools so that school boards aren't faced with that dilemma of hiring a nurse or a teacher, but can hire both because they have healthcare dollars to pay for healthcare and school fund dollars to pay for teachers.
So I'm going to stop this right here. I'll take a prerogative of the chair to stop the conversation. I'm going to draw some bright lines if I can, though. There's one bright line we should draw. One, when you're talking about kids getting injections of adrenaline or glucagon or cytocortif, that's one thing, and that's not a big deal. That's something we should be doing. You don't have to have a medical personnel to it. What you're talking about is really a much bigger topic and an important one. These are children who are medically fragile, who we have brought into our schools to, they have a mainline education. They have not moved from the doctor's offices. They've moved from institutions, and they moved from home care, where they never got a chance to get out of the house, and they were stuck there. We've moved them into a new setting, and I will tell you, I agree, the money has not followed the child in this issue. It's been compounded by ballot measure 5. But even with ballot measure 5 out of the picture, There wouldn't be money for these situations. It would still be the same situation. So we will do this. We will have a good look at what CCOs can do as far as bringing those monies into the school system to support those special needs and fragile children. But I want a bright line on this bill that what we're doing in this bill really isn't that part of that conversation. You know, lay personnel can do this. They can do this. The other part, it's tough. And if you had a school nurse, she wouldn't be skilled enough to take care of an intubated patient on a respirator. I don't have that training anymore. I did it for 5 years. I have to go back and relearn it. You need people trained just for doing that. And they can be lay people, too, but they got to be well trained. So we'll leave it there, and we'll pick it up another part of this committee's work at a later time. Thanks for bringing the topic up. So I'm going to close a public hearing on what was supposed to be a very simple little discussion on Senate Bill 875. And we're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 72, which I expect will take us the rest of the day at our present rate. Okay. And I'm going to call, we have six people signed up. I'm going to call them up in groups of three. Jana Bitten, Dr. Cozy, and Lance Cook will be the first three up, please. And they'll be followed by Rebecca Silva, Lisa Presnell, and Sarah Bays. Good morning.
Good morning.
2 minutes apiece.
I'll do my best.
Okay. Please introduce yourself, committee, and give us your testimony, please.
Excellent. Good morning. Thank you, Senator Bates and Representative Nathanson and members of the subcommittee. My name is Jana Bitten. I'm the executive director for the Oregon Center for Nursing, and I am here today to speak in support of Senate Bill 72, which will add a $9 surcharge onto nursing license fees to support the nursing workforce, the collection and research, and also convening of nursing collection and research around nursing workforce data, and also the convening of nursing groups together. The testimony that I have written is before you, as is the testimony from so many nurses across the state. When we found out that this hearing was going to be scheduled, one of the very first things I did was sent out a broad call to the nurses that I know and have connections with and asked them to please send in some testimony, and we got quite a few responses. We received a lot of responses from organizations such as the Oregon Nurses Association, which will be speaking later today, and also from the Oregon Council of Deans, the Oregon Council of Associate Degree and Practical Nursing Programs, the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, broad organizational support, as well as individual nurses from urban and rural communities who all wrote in and supported this. As I read the testimony, I basically saw the same kind of story that kept coming out. The Oregon Center for Nursing is, as many of you know, is an organization that has been operating for the last 13 years with a mission to ensure that Oregon has a superior, well-diverse, and a well-prepared and diverse nursing workforce. We do this by generating reports and putting together information about the nursing workforce so that we can answer questions for people. And then also, we turn that research into action by bringing nurses together and nursing leaders, employers, lawmakers, and individual nurses together so that we can actually turn those research findings and those recommendations into action. While as many of you know, I've met with many of you, and as many of you know, I'm pretty new to this position. And in the last year, as I've been reaching out to nurse leaders throughout the state, one thing that I have seen over and over again is another familiar story. People are looking for information about the nursing workforce. I am asked all the time and everywhere I go different questions, some of which I can answer and some of which I can't. We already collect a lot of information through the Oregon State Board of Nursing. We also collect information from the Employment Department, and we collect information from employers and schools. But it's only the Oregon Center for Nursing that actually brings together all of these different data sources to give us a good picture of what's happening in the state, and then also apply it to different research that's happening on a national level to find out whether what's happening here is actually happening in other places as well, and whether solutions that are happening in other places could be adapted to apply to where we to the Oregon as well. An example of some of the work that we've done is this infographic that I've given everybody a copy of. This gives us an information of a survey that we did about the faculty, nurse faculty in the state of Oregon. When we talk about whether we're going to have enough nurses to be able to support the population, especially a population that now has access to health care, who never had access to health care before, we need to remember that nursing, as the largest percentage of that the healthcare workforce, we want to make sure that they're well prepared. And if we are struggling with making sure that we can incent nurses to go into education and faculty roles, that's something that we want to keep an eye on. And that's something that we need to have an independent nonprofit organization who can have a long-term view of what is going to be happening with the nursing workforce so we can make sure that we have enough nurses to be able to meet the needs. Senate Bill 72, as you've probably read, is going to add a $9 surcharge to nursing license fees. It's true that it's not an increase in fee, but that's not how nurses are going to interpret it. We know that it's going to appear as a total fee increase. But we know that the nurses that we've talked to, and as we explain what it is that they're buying for that money, they see value in it, and they are willing to pay that extra $9 every 2 years, so it works out to be $4.50 a year. We anticipate that this will generate a little over $247,000 per year to do this work. This is based on an estimation of about 55,000 RN and LPNs who are licensed to work in the state of Oregon. We know that that number fluctuates, and it's not necessarily going to be the same from year to year, but that's the estimate that we're starting with. If this bill were to pass, one of the first things that we would do is hire a full-time researcher who would be on staff to be able to start pulling together that information and some of these long-term trend analysis pieces so that we can make sure that that data is coming in on a regular basis. We also know that the outcomes that we would get for this investment would be annually there would be 2 to 3 in-depth research reports that could be accomplished per year, which could be done if we had the full-time staff and we had the resources to be able to do that. We would also make sure that we would disseminate the information via website or even by print means, and that all of that dissemination would be free of charge. And then also annually we would have a conference where we bring nursing leaders together to disseminate some of the information that we provide. This is not the only nursing license surcharge that's being proposed. 11 other states across the United States fund their nursing workforce centers with license surcharges that are similar to this one, and it varies depending on the state. It can run anywhere from $3 to $40, just depending on how many nurses are in that state. Our neighbors to the north in Washington, they charge $5 per year, and every year when they pay their license fee, they pay $5 in order to do this. We are going through a time of change. The nursing community is going through a time of change just as the healthcare environment is changing right now. And we are at a time when nursing workforce centers are actually being established in states that have never had nursing workforce centers before. Oregon has always been ahead of the curve when it comes to nursing workforce, because we are one of the very first states that established a nursing workforce center. And this is a means by which we can ensure that the research that we do can be sustainable for now and the future. And with that, I end my testimony. Thank you very much, and I am happy to answer any questions you have.
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was fantastic testimony.
Thanks.
And, really, great job. And I know from being on the board of Northwest Health Foundation the incredible, valuable work that OCN does. This will allow you to enhance what you've been doing. How does this come? What percentage is $247,000 a year to the budget that you have now?
Thank you.
Or is it that you're running into more, it's harder and harder to get grants? Like, where does this fit into your overall revenue stream?
Absolutely. Senator Bates and Representative Nathanson and Representative Kenny Geyer, thank you. When the Oregon Center for Nursing first started, we relied heavily on state funding and also from funding from the Northwest Health Foundation and other private foundations. Over the years, financial priorities have changed, and they should. Mm-hmm. And because of that, we have scaled scaled back a lot of the work that we've done. This $247,000 does not even represent that. This represents about 50% of what our annual budget would be. Mm-hmm. Our board would still be responsible for fundraising events, the breakfast that we have, and other outreach that we do to other nurses to maintain individual and corporate donations. What we are asking for is will fund what the nursing community is telling me is most critical. Mm-hmm. There are other programs that the Oregon Center for Nursing has done. We have a podcast that we do, and we've done events around leadership development and leadership training and that sort of thing. This is specifically for the research and the data collection and bringing nurses together to be able to talk about that.
That's great. Thank you.
Thanks.
Co-chairs, Senator Bates, Representative Nathanson, and members of the subcommittee, thank you for the opportunity to speak. My name is Mary Cozy. I am from Happy Valley, Oregon, and I am a nurse. I am also the dean of Linfield Good Samaritan School of Nursing and a member of the Oregon Council of Deans. I arrived at Linfield about a year and a half ago, and I was immediately faced with a faculty shortage. About a third of my faculty had left for various reasons. That's 12 faculty out of 34. I was concerned about this. The first people I met when I arrived was Jana Bitten, and I talked about my immediate concerns, and I identified the faculty shortage. Over the 2 years that I've been here, I have only been able to fill about 7 of those 12 positions through a lot of recruiting. And I suspected that there were faculty-related issues that were across the state that fed into that problem. My administration, while very sympathetic to nursing, has no difficulty recruiting faculty into other areas of the college, and they were not understanding our difficulty. Because of the conversation I had with Jana, they did the faculty research survey, provided data about the state of the nursing faculty shortage in Oregon. I was able to couple that with some of the data we got nationally and provide a context for both my administration and my board of trustees. This has allowed them to think about different reimbursement packages and compensation packages that are relevant to nurses today, and as a result of implementing that, we've had far more interest in our open positions than we had prior to that. So I was incredibly grateful and immediately utilized the information available to me because of the work of the Oregon Center for Nursing. Doesn't solve all the problems we'd like it to, but it's a good start. The other issue that I have continuously as a dean is because we are a popular program, they're always pushing us to increase our enrollment. And based simply on demand, we could increase our enrollment by a great deal. What I have to temper that with is the actual need of the workforce out there. And the Oregon Center for Nursing provides us with the workforce needs. The last thing we want to do is educate too many nurses, have them graduate with private school loans, and not be able to have them have a job and be able to pay down their loans. So we are constantly taking that data that we get from the Oregon Center for Nursing and applying it to our enrollment situation so that we can pace the amount of enrollment and have the appropriate amount of nurses graduating. We want a well-educated workforce. We, of course, at Linfield believe that that's where we offer one of those great educations. But we also want to make sure that we are not flooding the workforce with nurses that cannot get jobs. It allows us to educate with an ethical perspective on how many that we're graduating. Another issue that we regularly run into is a problem of practice sites. We have a large school of nursing, and this year and in recent years, we're finding it more and more difficult to find practice sites, especially inpatient practice sites. We were wondering where the problem was, whether this was going to continue long term, and what we might be able to do as a school or in collaboration with the practice sites to make this a good collaborative solution for our students. The Oregon Center for Nursing at this time is now working with the Oregon State Board of Nursing to help design and implement a study looking at exactly that, at the demand and supply of inpatient clinical sites. that's important data, but also what it's really going to be able to do is bring us together around the table to talk about the best use of clinical sites and the best use of clinical education for nursing students so that they can ease that transition into practice. Without this collaborative effort between OCN and OSBN, that conversation would be a non-starter. So that's another way that I've used that data almost immediately. So I've been at Linfield for less than 2 years. I've in all three areas, significant areas of my role, which is enrollment, education, and faculty, I have used that data significantly. Without this particular source of neutral data, and as the convener of groups to come together, it would be much more difficult, almost impossible to do my job, or I'd be doing my job with far less information and far less direction. I want to state that I support, personally as a nurse, this particular bill. $9 to me, while I don't love having my fees increased, this is a great value. At less than $4.50 a year, at less than, I think I would need to do 14 hours of overtime in order to pay for this over a 2 year. Excuse me?
14 minutes.
14 minutes, yes, not hours. Say. 14 minutes of overtime over 2 years.
Like, what?
I'm sorry. I stand corrected. Let the records note that I meant 14 minutes. This is not any kind of pinch. Well, it will be something that many nurses will recognize as an added fee. I personally find this something very palatable in my profession. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to speak in front of you today, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony.
Good morning, Co-Chair Bates and Nathanson and members of the committee. My name is Lance Cook. I'm Vice President of the Oregon Student Nursing Association and a current student at Oregon Health and Science University, Portland campus. I came here today to speak in favor of Senate Bill 72, and to talk about what a good resource it is for us students. Among the many things that we're trying to do at the Oregon State Board, at the Oregon Student Nursing Association, is make students aware of current issues that nurses will have to face in the upcoming years. And the data provided by the Oregon Center for Nursing essentially does just that for us. I've talked to many of my classmates and educators about the nursing educator shortage, and we believe that we need to do more to facilitate nurse educators in our workforce. Nursing students that I've talked to are very grateful for some of the information that we've received from the Oregon Center for Nursing, such as information on where the current demand for nurses are in our state and where they can look to find work when they graduate. We at the Oregon Student Nursing Association are also looking to create training for the leadership needs of nursing in the future, with our scope of practice potentially increasing. There is more demand for more skills added to our skill set, and we intend to consult with the Oregon Center for Nursing on various different people that we can recruit for our leadership summit that we're going to be holding, hopefully in October. I just want to mention that all the students that I've talked to are very, believe that it's a very reasonable fee for the service that we're getting at $4.50 a year. I've heard commented that's less than what I would pay for lunch. Mm-hmm. Thank you for your time. I'm now happy to answer any questions that you have for me.
don't see any questions. So thank you for your testimony. Thank you very much. So Rebecca Silva, Lisa Presnell, and Sarah Basler. So introduce yourselves, committee, and I'd like to hear a testimony. Remember, it's only $9.
Got that. Co-chairs Nathanson and Bates and members of the subcommittee, my name is Lisa Maria Presnell. I keep getting mixed up because I just got married in December, so I'm Lisa Maria professionally and Presnell every other place, so we'll do both. I live in Clackham.
Welcome to my world.
Yeah, I'm really confused. I'm sorry. Let me start over with that. I live in Clackamas, Oregon, and I'm also the director of the School of Nursing at George Fox University, and I'm also a member of the Oregon Council of Deans, as Mary mentioned a few minutes ago. I've been a practicing RN for 33 years. I'm speaking today in favor of Senate Bill 72. For the past 13 years, the Oregon Center of Nursing has provided nurses and nursing leaders alike with information and resources needed to identify issues related to the nursing workforce in Oregon. This is important because it makes it possible for nurses at the bedside all the way through nurse executives to find, use, and apply data differently than we could prior to the existence of the Oregon Center for Nursing. And so I'd like to address a little of the history of the Oregon Center for Nursing, since I'm old enough to have been there when it happened, and also a little bit of the implications for my practice in various settings and at various levels over the years here in Oregon. I've been here about 21 years now, so this is all relevant to Oregon practice. Oregon Center for Nursing came into existence in 2002 because nursing service and education issues were identified by the Oregon Nursing Leadership Council at that time. It's now renamed. Oregon Nursing Leadership Council is and was a representative group of nurse leaders from across the state, and I had the honor of being a founding member of that group. We developed the Oregon Center for Nursing very specifically for the purpose of being able to address workforce issues at that time, which looked to us like a looming black cloud of nursing shortage. We didn't understand in our infancy quite what we were doing in terms of the bigger picture of workforce issues going forward, but we definitely did see the nursing workforce shortage at that time. This was the culmination of many, many years of discussion and work by nursing leaders across the state that started in the mid to late 90s and carried through until we were able to open until 2002, as I mentioned. Of note, this is where the practice issues come in. Of note, I was working night shift as a staff nurse during the same period that I was the chair of the Clackamas Community College Nursing Program and doing the work associated with the launch of OCN and the Oregon Nursing Leadership Council. That was difficult. I will just make an overarching statement. That was difficult, but that's what nursing educators do. They work a second job so that they can afford the luxury of teaching. And if you've heard that in sort of anecdotal statement in the past, I will let you know that I am one of those true case stories where it actually is the truth. I had a personal interest in seeing the system change so that I could afford to teach nursing and still feed my family. Oregon Centers for Nursing's role was designed by a group of determined nurses so that all nurses would have information provided by a deeper dive into those issues that were impacting the nursing shortage. We created Oregon Center for Nursing as a nonprofit organization dedicated to finding strategic solutions to the issues surrounding educating and keeping a competent, agile, and ready nursing workforce. We had a lot of opinions in nursing, we always do, but we didn't have a strategy for how to apply those effectively at that time. Again, my own perspective is that I had to work two jobs to afford to teach nursing full time, and I knew that my colleagues as faculty did the same. That said, I also worried that my patients that I was caring for during those 12-hour night shifts after working a full week of clinicals and teaching may not have been getting the best care that I could have offered because of the fact that I was exhausted in the process. Again, I wasn't alone. Part of that difficulty for me as a staff nurse surrounded the fact that I was working in a specialized role in nursing And there were no other people qualified to do what I did in the middle of the night. And if someone called off sick and I came in, I was it. Or if I got sick, I sometimes still went to work. And it was in an area of infant resuscitation. I'll just say that off the top of my head so that people know this was challenging. But the nursing shortage definitely affected that because we were not able to have enough qualified people move into the higher ranks of practice nursing at the bedside to be able to perform that function at the time. So while other units were overflowing with nurses, mine was continually short. Nurses' careers are in a very real way shaped by the questions and answers to these types of personal stories. In Oregon, we've looked at patients' lives and well-being depending on the nurse's ability to also answer these questions effectively. Nothing in nursing is static. It's not in Oregon for sure. And we must have reliable and valid data to make decisions upon for the safety and health of our patients and the public. OCN answered that call, and it still does, at all levels and in all healthcare venues, to have independent, actionable data on issues that directly impact the nursing workforce in Oregon. And the relevance of that to education is that we also need that data to know how to respond to the public changes in healthcare so that we are producing, as Mary mentioned, the type and quality of nurse that's required by the public in order to have a viable workforce and a qualified workforce for Oregon. I want to just mention that Oregon Center for Nursing, in my mind, has a mantra of analyze the data as your mission instead of analyzing the data to support your mission. And I really think that is a short, quick, easy to remember way, elevator line that we can all remember in terms of trying to explain what work Oregon Center for Nursing does for all nurses, bedside all the way through administration. They will take the time, they have the knowledge, and they support the art and science of nursing as we search for solutions to our nursing workforce's needs. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today, and I can now take any questions if you have.
Thank you for a testimony. I'm going to hold questions until we have the entire panel.
Thank you. My name is Rebecca Silva. I am a nursing student at Mount Hood Community College in Gresham, Oregon. I am also a board member of the Oregon Student Nurses Association. So good morning, co-chairs Bates and Nathanson. Thank you, and the committee. A much of the information has already been given, so I'll just go on to a personal note. I am a little bit later in life. I'm coming into nursing as a second degree student, and so I launched right into my journey with the need for information. I wanted all the information I could possibly get to make the best possible decisions as I planned my professional development path. I wanted research, and the OCN was the one place I could go, the one trusted source that I found. There's so much stuff on the internet. Most of it's not backed by viable research, and so the OCN was my trusted source. I immediately made all the right phone calls, wrote all the right checks, very confident that everything that I was doing was moving me forward in the best possible way, and so I'm here to tell you that I love the confidence that I have now. As I have my career trajectory all planned out, the OCN was a huge part of that, and so I am in favor of this surcharge. I'm willing to pay for that confidence. Thank you so much for your time. I'm available for questions.
Thank you for your testimony. I think more universities and colleges should give that kind of advice to their students. We wouldn't have student debt that's up to our most while you're waiting tables because your degree in medieval literature didn't exactly pay off. So.
Good morning, co-chairs Bates and Nathanson and members of the committee. My name is Sarah Basler. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Nurses Association in support of Senate Bill 72. Throughout its history, the Oregon Center for Nursing has been a critical partner of the Oregon Nurses Association, and for most of its history, ONA has had a staff member serve as a board member of OCN, so the two organizations have worked very closely together. OCN, as you've already heard, has a history of research on priority issues facing nursing in Oregon, specifically around the nursing workforce and around the nursing faculty shortage. This research has proved very valuable to nurses, to employers, and to policymakers. And really, no other organization is poised to do this body of research that OCN has already demonstrated an ability to deliver on. Questions like, as our healthcare system evolves, questions like, will the supply of nurses meet the demand, and how do we ensure that it does? As you can imagine, ONA really carefully considered whether to support the surcharge because it's a fee that nearly all of our members will pay. We've had discussions with the Oregon Center for Nursing really over the course of several years about what a fee proposal might look like and whether ONA could support that. Over the past year, those discussions intensified, and we worked really closely with the Oregon Center for Nursing as they were developing their proposal. And we really want to thank OCN for taking our feedback and, in response to that, really modifying both the size and the scope of the proposal that's before you today. The criteria that ONA used to evaluate whether we could support a license surcharge for nurses was, does it fund unique work that is not redundant with work that's being done elsewhere in Oregon? Is that work valuable to ONA members and to the nursing community as a whole? And would the proposal generate enough money to sustain that key function, but really not more than that? And we're confident that the $9 proposal that you have before you meets those criteria, and it is right-sized. And so ONA enthusiastically urges your support of Senate Bill 72. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
Just a comment. That was fantastic testimony all the way around. Very excited about this bill. And I just want to put a plug in for the work for the – there was a Senate bill – I forget the number – that was looking at workforce needs in relation to the rural credit. And I hope that OCN has a big role in that because nursing is a big piece of that credit, hopefully. And understanding where the specific needs are, both by geographic region and maybe by specialty, would be really helpful. So thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. I'll just make a quick comment. Our personal lives often interact with what we do here. And as a practicing physician, I work every day with nurses. And it's only $9, and I pretty well do what they tell me to do, okay? And that's about the way it goes, okay? So you guys want this, I'm there, because I got to face you, you know, on the ward, so I'm not going to take that battle on, all right, over $9, okay? So thank you for your testimony. We're going to close a public hearing on Senate Bill 72 and move to a public hearing on Senate Bill 696. I know we had one person sign up who actually left. I'll speak to the bill myself just quickly for the committee here, and others can come up if they want to. This was up to about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, maybe 3 weeks ago, a consensus bill. It fixed some problems that we'd run into from our previous legislation, and that basically was that we had set up a board to take care of what's called applied behavior analysis, which is a way of treating and helping autistic children. And we had inadvertently set up a board that actually had supervision over other boards, which was inappropriate. This bill fixes that. We also had some difficulty with the board itself. This bill is going to fix that by putting it under the jurisdiction of the Senate for confirmation. And also grandfathers in some people who are already doing this type of work, but not have the actual credentials we're going to require in the future. We have a method here for grandfathering in what everyone has a consensus on. What kind of slowed us down was that the board makeup itself has what I call ABAers on it, which people who do applied behavior analysis, and some other professionals, psychiatrists, psychologists, pediatricians, that come and do this work. And there's been a kerfunkel about how many ABAers we should have. Should it be 5 out of 9 or 4 out of 9? And then count the pediatricians those the other way. We have an amendment which we think is going to reach that consensus. And we should have that done, and we can bring it back to you when we're ready to do a work session. But during work sessions, we don't have a lot of conversations, so I want to get that out now. If people have specific questions about a rather complex bill, please feel free to come and talk to me, and I'll fill you in on it. But when it comes back, it should be a consensus bill, so there'll be less problems. Holly, you want to speak to this real quickly?
Sure. Senator Bates, Representative Nathanson, members of the committee. My name is Holly Mercer. I'm the director of the Health Licensing Office. We had the task of implementing Senate Bill 365 from last session, and we have learned a great deal about the philosophy around applied behavior analysis. Insurance issues were taken care of in the last year. We are faced with what we believe is actually a very good bill going forward, although we are neutral. We remain neutral as an agency, but we have lived with this board and these issues for a year, and we feel strongly that the proposals that are in this bill, and thank you, Senator Bates, for your help and patience through this process, will be beneficial. And we will still have some philosophical disagreements, no doubt about it, but this is definitely moving in the right direction. One of the key pieces is that we moved this board under the jurisdiction of the Health Licensing Office. Gives us a lot more flexibility in terms of getting licenses out the door. Right now, we have to call a board meeting every month so that we can issue licenses, and it just did not synchronize with the rest of our board. So we look forward to it. We will make it work, Senator.
Thank you. And it has tried my patience in ways you can't possibly imagine. It cost me 3 glasses of wine before I got through. That's 2 over my limit. Okay. So any questions? I expect not.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to close a public hearing on Senate Bill 696, and I believe our work is done today. We don't have, I don't believe anyway, any more committee meetings scheduled. They will be a lot more before we're through. Right now, we're still putting the other budgets and working hard on those, and we'll be sharing that with you as we go along. We have not made any final decisions. I don't want to speak for my co-chair, but I think we're in a position right now. We're doing some really interesting and in-depth work that has not been done for some years, and I think we'll come back with some proposals to you that you can look at and think about and give us some feedback on. So I look forward to getting that done. Hopefully we'll have it done in the next week or two, and we'll get the information back out to you so you can look at it and say what you think. So I appreciate your patience and your work, and I'm sorry it took so long this morning, but I can't cross nurses, so that's the way it goes, baby. Any questions? Stay on alert, then we'll give you a call when we have our next meeting. We are adjourned.
I sense mental health.